This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Celie Hatton. In the early hours of Monday, the 27th of April, these are our main stories. The latest on the shooting at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Donald Trump has reacted angrily when asked about the shooting suspect's alleged manifesto. We also hear from the journalist who was sitting next to the U.S. president when the shooting happened. And Mali's defense minister has been assassinated in a car bomb attack, part of a wave of jihadist and Tuareg separatist-led violence sweeping the country. Also in this podcast...
an historic performance, 159-30. Absolutely incredible. I've never seen anything like that. What a finish.
A big day for the London Marathon as a Kenyan athlete smashes the world record. Our top story. More than 24 hours on from a believed assassination attempt on the U.S. president and his cabinet, the third time Donald Trump appears to have been targeted in less than 2 years, we'll look at the questions being raised about the suspect behind that attack and how he might have got past security. This latest violent episode happened at one of Washington's glitziest annual events, the White House Correspondents' Dinner. A suspect, Cole Thomas Allen, will appear before a D.C. court on Monday morning local time. We'll hear more details about him in a moment. But first, in an interview with American media, Donald Trump has said he wasn't worried during the believed assassination attempt on him and his cabinet during the Saturday evening event. In an interview with CBS correspondent Nora O'Donnell, he said his curiosity to see what was happening probably slowed the Secret Service's efforts to rush him to safety. Mr. Trump then reacted angrily when Ms. O'Donnell read out portions of a manifesto allegedly written by the gunman that appeared to refer to the president as a rapist.
The so-called manifesto is a stunning thing to read, Mr. President. He appears to reference a motive in it. He writes this, quote, administration officials, they are targets. And he also wrote this, I am no longer willing to permit a pedophile, rapist, and traitor to coat my hands with his crimes. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I was waiting for you to read that because I knew you would, because you're horrible people, horrible people. Yeah, he did write that. I'm not a rapist. I didn't rape anybody.
Do you think he was referring to you?
Excuse me. I'm not a pedophile. You read that crap from some sick person. I got associated with all stuff that has nothing to do with me. I was totally exonerated.
Our North America correspondent is Peter Bowes. I asked him, what do we know about this alleged manifesto?
It is an alleged manifesto. We haven't been able to independently verify these writings, but it has been widely reported, and you've just heard some questioning about it. We also understand from US officials that in this manifesto, he had essentially set out who his targets were, and that they were senior members of the Trump administration. And certainly leading officials have said that they understand that to be Donald Trump and his closest officials. Now, we know that Donald Trump and his vice president, the first lady, were all present at this event at the weekend, along with many other members of the cabinet and indeed members of Congress as well. And these are the details that are in these writings that I think clearly are going to be part of the investigation, which the authorities say clearly is still in the very early stages.
And Peter, serious questions are also being asked about how would-be attackers keep getting past security cordons. But the president himself has been defending the security arrangements that were in place.
Defending it, he says, because the alleged attacker in this case did not get into the room. In fact, he didn't even get to the floor where the ballroom is. So he was still some distance away from the room itself. And for that reason, he says that security actually worked, although clearly questions are being asked about the fact that someone with a gun was in the building with the president there and the vice president and other senior members of the government. And that is what is concerning a lot of people. And the president has referred to the fact that this was a working hotel. Now, this place has been used for decades for this particular correspondence annual dinner, White House correspondence. But he says it's a working hotel. There are many people in the rooms above the ballroom who have nothing to do with the event but clearly have access to the building. So that could be a potential hole in the security and is potentially something they'll be looking at in the future.
And just briefly, Peter, there are plans to have another White House Correspondents' Dinner. The president's been talking.
Yes, he's been saying that he would like to see it happen within 30 days. He added that he would like to see it with some additional security, especially around the perimeter, which does seem to have been the major criticism of what happened on Saturday, that this person was able to get through a perimeter, if indeed that kind of thing existed, as far as a security cordon was concerned. So I think he wants to see more layers of security around the building.
Peter Bowes. The suspect, 31-year-old Cole Thomas Allen, is from Torrance, a Los Angeles suburb where he's reported to have worked as a tutor. Our correspondent Reagan Morris spent most of the day outside his home. She joined us from Torrance.
The FBI descended on this neighborhood, on this house. Neighbors said there were three helicopters up from news media and law enforcement. There was a huge law enforcement presence and the FBI going through the house. And since then, it's just been chaos with media. We're all sort of out here talking to the same neighbors. Many of them don't want to speak to us. Some of them were happy to speak to the BBC, but not local news because they don't want to be on locally, but they'll talk to us.
And some details emerging about the suspect himself, and real shock for some of those who knew him.
The authorities say they believe that Cole Allen traveled by train from here in Torrance to Washington, D.C. That's almost 3,000 miles. And that's a journey, you know, we don't have very fast, efficient, high-speed trains here in the U.S., so it's a journey that would take several days, but it also is a journey that allows you to bring weapons undetected. We understand that he legally did own some firearms. We're hearing that this man, he was 31 years old, he has one of the best educations that money can buy in the United States. He went to one of the most prestigious colleges, has a degree in engineering from Caltech, and then apparently he has an advanced master's degree, so he's very well educated. He was working, according to his LinkedIn social media profiles, he was working as a part-time software developer, video game developer, and he also worked as a tutor in one of these education centers that high school teenagers go for tutoring help with physics and math and to prepare for their own exams. So, you know, we've heard from some people who had been tutored by him. We spoke to some of the neighbors, and across the board, you know, people say he kind of kept to himself, but he was a nice guy. He was quiet. People are really shocked.
He seemed like a very ordinary person, you know. It's just, you never expect it coming from this guy. He was a nice guy, down-to-earth guy. I got a lot of help in my physics homework and prepared for tests with him, as well as one of my other buddies. So yeah, you know, it's just something you never expect.
And Reagan, as you mentioned, he traveled by train for days to get to his destination. So this wasn't a spur of the moment decision.
This seems like it was a planned event. And you know, a lot of the details we're going to hear more and more when he's formally charged on Monday. We'll definitely learn more. But President Trump himself was doing some media interviews where he said that before Cole Allen allegedly stormed into that Hilton hotel lobby, President Trump said that this young man alerted his family and that the family indeed are the ones who called police. You know, a lot of these details we have not been able to independently verify, but I know that we are going to learn many more details when he's formally charged Monday morning in Washington.
Reagan Morris in California. Well, we've heard many journalists who were in the same room as President Trump give their accounts of what happened at the Washington Hilton Hotel. But one correspondent was in a unique position. Weijia Jiang from CBS News also functions as the president of the White House Correspondents Association. She was sitting next to Donald Trump on the stage at the event. This was a big moment for her. This was the first time he had agreed to attend the dinner as president. Also, Weijia and the president have had some tricky exchanges in the past. During the COVID pandemic, he abruptly brought a news conference to an end when he was annoyed by one of her questions. Weijia was interviewed on CBS's Face the Nation by Margaret Brennan on Sunday. Here's what she told her about Saturday's dramatic events.
When we were still on stage, we were in the middle of a very light moment with the entertainer who was doing a trick. And when I heard something in the audience, I thought it was a protester, something we're very used to. Mm-hmm. But then when I saw SWAT team members come to the head table and rush us to the ground and say, down, down, down. We were crawling off the stage. And in the back, that is a holding area where people wait, including President Trump and distinguished guests, to go onto the stage. And we were sitting there, and I saw more than a dozen SWAT officers. Mm-hmm. There were members of the Secret Service milling about. There were members of the president's team. And as you can imagine, a lot of conflicting information because it had just unfolded. I will say it was remarkable to see that in action and to understand it was their quick work that protected all of us that night. But obviously, it was a tough situation for everybody that was there, including you.
You were very stoic, though. You had to go out. You had to talk to everyone. Your 7-year-old daughter was there. Your parents were there. Mm-hmm. Your husband was there. Mm-hmm. How are you making sense of that? Have you? I think we're processing this still.
I think we're all processing it. I have covered countless shootings and murders and terrible things in my career. And this is the first time that I've been on the other side of a potentially violent and deadly situation. And no amount of reporting can prepare you for that. You're right that my family was in the audience, and it was incredibly meaningful to have them there. And so that added an additional complicated layer because I'm thinking about the safety of my members, the safety of all of our dinner guests, and obviously at the forefront, the safety of the people who I can see who matter the most to me. And we didn't have information. Yeah. So when I was in the back, I didn't know if there was an active threat. I was watching the monitors and keeping my eyes right on their table. But at the same time, trying to find more information mm-hmm. so I could share it with everyone in that room. And President Trump called me to his holding room and briefed me before he sent out a post about the dinner being, in his words, postponed, and that he was going to have a press conference. And he really wanted to talk it through and to explain that he himself realized how important that night was. It's something we do every night. And when I did address the room, I reminded everyone that the freedoms that we are celebrating tonight in the First Amendment are still incredibly fragile. And I appreciate that the president acknowledged that.
Wei-Jia Jiang from CBS, the president of the White House Correspondents Association. The commander of Ukraine's drone forces has told the BBC that long-range attacks on Russia's oil export facilities are legitimate military targets and will escalate after weeks of strikes deep inside Russia that have severely disrupted its energy exports. Speaking in a rare interview, Robert Brovdy said Vladimir Putin earned blood money on oil exports, which he then spent waging war on Ukraine. The commander also said that his forces were currently stalling Russia's advances along the front line. Our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, traveled to meet the drone commander and his troops.
We've just pulled up by the side of a road in the middle of a field somewhere in eastern Ukraine. We've come in a convoy of soldiers, and they're just getting into position because tonight they're going to be launching drones deep into Russia.
The location is top secret, and Yuki, one of the soldiers, tells me they have to work fast.
Our center is like a red rag to our enemy because we're bringing the war to their territory.
Those drones revving their engines look like big toy planes, but this model can fly more than 1,000 kilometres, and Ukraine has others now that go twice that far. For weeks, they've been hitting oil facilities deep inside Russia.
The team are ready now for the launch, just waiting for the signal. Some contacts here who are giving us a ride in a minibus with completely blacked out windows, not even a crack to see where we're going, to meet Robert Brovdy. He's the commander of Ukraine's drone forces. And we've just emerged into the command centre. banks and banks of screens in every direction. Hey, good to meet you.
Hello, nice to meet you, Commander Brody.
4 years ago, Robert Brovdy was a grain dealer and an art collector, more comfortable in Sotheby's than in the trenches where he's since found himself. That's where, he tells me, he first used a drone. He was under fire and needed to see where the Russian forces were and remembered a device that he'd bought for his children. Soon, he was attaching munitions to ever more advanced drones. Brovdy now heads all Ukraine's unmanned systems forces.
So there seems to be this new focus on deep strikes in Russia. Can you tell me why? What's the thinking?
Putin extracts natural resources and converts them into blood dollars that they can then direct against us in the form of Shahed drones and ballistic missiles. If oil refineries are a tool to convert resources into money that's used for war, then these are lawful military targets subject to destruction.
The internet is full of video clips of the results. Giant orange walls of fire. Brovdy's bunker, though, displays other videos on a loop. Set to music, they show drones chasing Russian soldiers on the front line. It is brutal stuff. But for Brovdy, reducing Russia's manpower advantage is the second priority. And for 4 months, he says, Ukraine has been killing more soldiers than Moscow has mobilized for the fight.
30% of all drone strikes by the unmanned forces must be against military personnel.
So there's like a kill plan, basically, for Russia.
Yes, you can call it a kill plan. And right now, we are exceeding that. The greatest mass killing of an enemy in the history of mankind is taking place in this room, by plastic and metal drones that cost from $300 to a few thousand dollars. They are the main tool of influence on the battlefield.
And he tells me his drone forces have already stopped the Russians advancing along most of the front line. And the long-range launches continue. Brovdy doesn't talk of defeating the enemy, but of defending what Ukraine still holds with minimal losses to its own troops. And by taking the war to Russia with these deep strikes, he also wants to eat into Russians' morale and make more people there question the war they're fighting and Vladimir Putin, who led them there.
Sarah Rainsford in eastern Ukraine. The military junta in Mali has confirmed that the defense minister was killed on Saturday during widespread attacks by jihadist militants and separatist fighters. A statement on Sunday evening said General Sadio Camara died in a suicide truck bombing at his residence near the capital, Bamako. Officials said he exchanged fire with the attackers and managed to neutralize some of them before succumbing to his injuries. His death is a major blow for the military government, since he was a key link with the Russian mercenaries who support the junta. In a separate development, the Tuareg separatists in the north say they've reached an agreement for the Russians to leave. Our West Africa reporter Makuachi Okafor gave this update on the continued fighting in Mali.
The military junta said it continued this fight against the two groups who sort of came together to fight them. First is the FLA, which is the Tuareg group trying to break away from the country. And then ICADA-linked group called Jenim, which is also trying to install their rulership there. The military did say that they have remained and that they are trying to take back many parts of the country, including Kidal and Kati and even other parts. They've also installed curfews and increased sort of patrols and checkpoints in the city. In a statement that they shared today, they said 16 people died, including some members of the military and civilians, but they didn't give specifics which members were impacted.
And the significance of this claim that Russians have withdrawn the mercenaries from fighting in the north of Mali?
I think it's quite significant if indeed it's true. And this is because for many years, the north has been the region that the FLA has been trying to take. And the Russian mercenaries there have also been trying to just help the junta push back and fight back in that region. FLA spokesperson told the BBC that actually they reached an agreement with Russian forces to allow for this withdrawal. It's not clear why maybe this sort of agreement could have happened. And according to him, the deal was to see that they remove their snipers and full engagement from the city. I know I saw a couple of posts he made on X about what appeared to be military vehicles leaving, but if indeed happened, then it would be impactful in the region.
Our West Africa reporter, Makuachi Okafor. Still to come in this podcast, an orangutan on a canopy bridge is a sight to behold.
Waiting for this moment for 2 years has been excruciating. So when it finally happened, yeah, we were absolutely overjoyed.
What does this mean for conservation efforts in Indonesia? This is the Global News Podcast. A moment in athletics history today. Sebastian Sawe of Kenya has become the first athlete to run a competitive marathon in under 2 hours. It's an achievement many commentators thought could not be done. He won the men's race in London with a time of 1 hour, 59 minutes and 30 seconds.
Sebastian Sawe is going to break the 2 hour mark. He's going to win the London Marathon in incredible style. An historic performance, 1:59.30. Absolutely incredible. I've never seen anything like that. What a finish.
Remarkably, another athlete, the Ethiopian Yomif Kejelcha, making his London Marathon debut, became the second man to run under 2 hours in the same race. He came in second. The marathon winner, Sebastian Sawe, beat the previous best race time by more than a minute. With such a massive leap from the last world record, there are bound to be questions about doping. But a testing regime designed and implemented by the Athletics Integrity Unit, or AIU, an independent body set up by World Athletics, has consistently found him to be drug-free. My colleague, Owen Bennett-Jones, spoke to Claudio Berardelli, the runner's coach, and asked, did he expect the two-hour barrier to be broken?
Maybe not really sub two, but Sebastian was ready for a good one, definitely. And then perfect day, perfect conditions. So, and then something quite incredible came.
I mean, it really is a big change in the speed in which people are doing it. What's changed?
Well, I would say technology is definitely playing a huge role because we had an incredible shoe from Adidas, our main sponsor. What is also changing is the level of fueling, more carbs. The level of training, it has improved a lot in the years, and athletes, they have learned how to recover much better. And then, of course, I have to say the truth as coach of Sebastian Sawe. Sebastian is an exceptional athlete. I've been coaching in Kenya for 22 years and I thought I had seen pretty much everything, but Sebastian is showing me something which, honestly, I never thought to see.
And you know, I'm going to ask you the next question because you've taken a lot of measures to try and get rid of this issue, but some of your athletes have been done for doping and you have tried to get a lot of tests on Sebastian Sawe to show he's not doing it. Presumably, you're going to face that claim.
Yeah, well, I mean, Kenya is facing definitely a problem. And we had also, yes, in our group, some few cases. And then we thought it was time to do something because Sebastian and I knew that maybe a day like today could have come. So, and then we approached AIU and then we came up with this idea. And then, Sebastian is still continuing in having a very specific, intense anti-doping protocol. Yeah.
I mean, the idea is what, tests about every 3 days?
Yeah, that was initially what we did before Berlin last year. But then AIU came to us and he said, okay, you guys, you're still giving us a budget, but we think that every 3 days doesn't make much sense. It's too much. So still, Sebastian, compared to any other athlete, is being tested much more.
He's getting many more tests than any other marathon runner. Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, right.
So what next? I mean, presumably you're looking for more.
This one was only marathon number 4 for Sebastian, so in a sense, he's still quite a new marathon runner. So for what I've seen in training, I think we still have room and more space for improvement. And of course, now we have to go back and think what is next. Maybe Olympics are not too far away. And I'm sure we got interesting things ahead of us.
What is it about this part of Kenya that delivers these people?
from my opinion, is about definitely something to do with their physiology, but I think it's also very cultural. I think that, I don't know, maybe running is like football in Brazil. I mean, kids, they start running at a very young age, and more or less most of the people in Kenya, at least during their school time, they have tried to run. So you can imagine how many young kids that are approaching athletics, and then eventually you can find very good talents.
Claudio Berardelli speaking about that record run by the Kenyan Sebastian Sowe. The latest from the U.S. war with Iran now. A ceasefire is still in place. However, there's been little progress in formal peace talks, with major differences remaining on the big sticking points, namely the still-closed Strait of Hormuz and Tehran's nuclear program. But behind the scenes, diplomacy is still taking place. Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, has arrived in Russia for scheduled talks with President Putin. But before that, he stopped off in Pakistan, whose government is mediating the peace talks, for the second time in 2 days. Why did he return? Chiara Gol from the BBC's Persian service is in the Pakistani capital, Islamabad.
I think foreign minister obviously brought back another proposal from Iranian side. When he was here, he met the chief of Pakistani army. Iranian said they have offered a comprehensive proposal. So when that proposal was passed to the United States, obviously President Trump canceled his envoy's trip to Islamabad. And again, Mr. Araghchi's team split to two parts. One part with him, they went to Muscat, and another part with his plane went back to Tehran to consult with the new proposal they got from the United States. And again, I think they have a new proposal. Again, they came back here. They don't want to talk about what's the issue, but the newspaper, which is very close to Revolutionary Guards and Iranian officials in Iran, they say the nuclear program is not on the table. And that is the red line for them. And even one of the newspapers said there will be a new regime in the Strait of Hormuz. It would never be the same as before. And also they said they have to talk about the paying damage to Iran for the war, and also the war must stop permanently. But on the other hand, you can see there is a mountain apart. The nuclear program enrichment and also enriched uranium are the red line for United States and President Trump. And last time, in the last negotiation, we know that the main reason, an obstacle on the way to agreeing, was the nuclear program. The U.S. wanted to halting the nuclear program or limit it, but the Iranian didn't accept it. Obviously, the negotiation didn't reach to any agreement.
GR Goal in Islamabad. A man described as having chronicled the soul of India, the renowned photographer Raghu Rai, has died at the age of 83. His photographs range from pictures of world-famous people, including Mother Teresa and the Dalai Lama, as well as victims of war and images of everyday life. A colleague called him the greatest to ever hold a camera from our country. Bangladeshi photographer and activist Shahidul Alam knew him well. What made Raghu Rai so good?
He was very unusual in the fact that he was the photographer who was equally at ease with colour and black and white. And really, the sensitivity with which he approached his work was pretty phenomenal. If you look at the subjects that he covered, I mean, he essentially was an encyclopedia of contemporary Indian history. He photographed Mother Teresa, Indira Gandhi, her assassination and its aftermath, the Bhopal tragedy, the emergency that she brought in, ordinary things, extraordinary things, and he was able to slip from one to the other with ease. And there was a tactile element in his work, which is pretty special. I think he took you into the middle of the image. You were there. But for me, I think it was also the fact that he was not simply recording, he was witnessing. So a few images, for instance, the one of Indira Gandhi with surrounded by her cabinet, it's an iconic image. But Raghu actually gets behind the prime minister, photographs her from the back. She's the only one sitting. You have these people surrounding her. Their body language, the symbolism within his images is so phenomenal. I've rarely seen politics and power depicted in such succinct terms by a photographer. There are several of his books. I'm biased. Raghu Rai did a lot of work on Bangladesh and negatives which he'd lost for a long time and rediscovered. So his recent book on Bangladesh, The Price of Freedom, and then there is another version of it, which I think is very well produced. But Kolkata was one of his favorite cities, so he would go back, and there are wonderful images of Kolkata that Raghu has. But I think Mother Teresa, Indira Gandhi are very special people that he was able to photograph in a way very few other people have done.
Shahidul Alam looking back on the life of Raghu Rai. And last to Indonesia, where a camera hidden in the rainforest has captured what's thought to be a world first, a Sumatran orangutan slowly crossing a specially installed bridge. The newsroom's Anna Aslam tells us why this marks an important moment.
Sumatran orangutans are critically endangered because of habitat loss and illegal hunting. So there were particular fears for one community when a road was built through their rainforest, splitting the population in two. Experts worried that inbreeding could cause health implications and further reduce the species' chance of survival. Helen Buckland is from Indonesia's SOS conservation charity.
Orangutans are particularly vulnerable to genetic bottlenecks when this road stopped them being able to travel through the landscape. That could, over time, lead to local and functional extinction.
Helen's team worked with others to build canopy bridges above the road to help the 350 orangutans in the area move around. Other animals quickly started using the bridges, squirrels, langurs, gibbons, but no orangutans, until a young male finally braved the crossing.
Waiting for this moment for 2 years has been excruciating, I would say. So when it finally happened, yeah, we were absolutely overjoyed. Honestly, it was absolutely wonderful to see it.
Footage shows the orangutan slowly edge onto the narrow suspended bridge, holding a rope overhead for balance. He stops to look around and back at the camera before making it to the other side of the forest. Helen Buckland says there's a growing need for such wildlife corridors.
We really would like to see these bridges replicated where roads are cutting through forests. It really can help for people and wildlife to live in coexistence alongside each other.
Orangutans have excellent memories and can make mental maps of new routes through their habitat. So, with the young male paving the way for others, these bridges could help stitch a fragmented forest back together.
Anna Aslam. And that's all from us for now. If you want to get in touch, you can email us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at BBC World Service. Use the hashtag Global News Pod. And don't forget our sister podcast, The Global Story, which goes in depth and beyond the headlines on one big story. This edition of the Global News Podcast was mixed by Philip Bull, and the producer was Ed Horton. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Celia Hatton. Until next time, goodbye.